welcome to this massive auditorium. My name is Dean Wells. I work in the Windows Server team under the Assurance pillar. That's an area in Windows Server where we focus on the security technologies that are present in Windows Server 2016 and in Windows 10 as well. With me, I have Jane. Jane works across the same set of security features as I do. In this particular session, our aim is to give you some insight, both via the technical underpinnings in the OS architecture and via demonstrations into some of these particular features. So that's the goal. So why don't we kick it off with some context refresher? I will point out at this particular stage in the show, I'm hoping most of you have realized that security is a trend. It's running right the way through everything in Windows Server 2016. It cropped up in keynote after keynote. It cropped up in a foundation session that I delivered to a room similarly sized to this that was packed with about 1,500 people. But this is the message that Windows Server 2016 is intentionally trying to send. It's about security, and it's about software-defined data centers. And those two things do indeed go hand in hand. So I'll give you the background, but I'll do it perhaps a little more quickly than I normally would, knowing that you've probably seen it before. This particular quote is still one of my favorites, and I believe it to be accurate. If anybody would like to question the validity of that, I'd love to have a conversation with you afterwards. This is a very, very insightful quote. Simple, but insightful. In addition, we've got some numbers here that are frankly quite scary. Take a look at the impact of lost productivity and growth based upon cyber attacks. $3 trillion. That's a lot of money even by Microsoft standards. It's an awful lot of money there, and that's solely related to IT theft. I will state that that's not just in the US. That is aggregated across some 20-plus countries. But nonetheless, the amount of money is mind-blowing. So here's the state of the union. This is what's happening today in our IT environments, in everybody's representative enterprise or the public sector, the finance sector. We know that cyber attacks are on the rise. They're getting more frequent. And we've got a few additional ones that came in late that made it onto this board here. Ransomware is becoming more and more prominent. We need to have defenses against that. These people are the, if you can excuse the phrase, the scum of the earth. Anybody who will deliberately charge money to give you back data that was yours to begin with, I don't know of a better phrase to describe them than scum of the earth. That's ransomware. And it's also very, very difficult to deal with because they're attacking small companies with ransomware. That's what we're seeing as a somewhat of a trend. They go after the smaller companies that don't have devoted IT departments. They don't have dedicated specialists in IT. My wife's company, by pure coincidence, was actually hit by this. And she called me on the request of her boss to ask what to do. I said, restore a backup. She said, okay, I'll tell them to do that. So they restored a backup, and it was still encrypted. I said, okay, yeah, just keep going back. Keep looking at each backup. Go back 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Eventually, they went back 4 days, and they got everything back, obviously, with the loss of the updates over that four-day period. They restored that and then carried on. They called me 2 hours later saying, the documents are starting to encrypt themselves again. I'm like, yeah, you missed that piece where I said restore them onto freshly installed computers. You have to flatten them. You've got to pave these boxes. The malware was still there. So from a small company's standpoint, this was monumentally difficult for them to deal with. From our standpoint, this is kind of obvious, which is why they're not going after the larger enterprises as frequently. And then we get to the car hacking piece. Well, I don't know about you, but I have a BMW, and I can reach into that car, and I can lock its doors, unlock its doors, switch on the air conditioning, find out where it is on the planet. If I can do that remotely, then I suspect that I could probably turn the engine on or off. And since its gears are all computer controlled, I suspect I could control those remotely too, at least with a crisp piece of hacking. So carjacking and car hacking is soon going to be a prominent thing as well. And I think Tesla is going to be the one that paves the way for that to happen with the level of intelligence in that particular car. There's a hidden cost, though. These are the more interesting ones. Those are some big numbers, I'll grant you. But take a look at this. Before a breach, customers pay you for whatever service it is that you offer. After the breach, you give them compensation dollars to keep them as your customer. That's not a joke. It's a realistic statement of fact. Employees efficiently perform the majority of work on computer desktops. Now what do? They're running back and forth to a fax machine, assuming, one, you still have one, and if you do, can you find it? It's not an efficient means of working anymore. Appropriately sized and dedicated IT teams, and then you get that knee-jerk reaction, and you overreact, and you end up throwing far more people at it than was originally necessary to dig you out of the hole that you're now buried in. Then there's another one here. Credibility is lost. Before the attack, corporate secrets, people are happy to upload them to you, so you're a public cloud provider. After the fact, you've lost some of that credibility, if not all of it, and you may lose the customer completely. assets available on a day-to-day basis that are important to the operation of the business, they end up encrypted. This would be the ransomware one. Last but not least, customers are happy to trust you with their PII. They're sure as hell not going to be happy to do that afterwards. So, with all that said, let's take a look at what these timelines look like. I will point out that if you have seen this slide before, it was mine originally. It was stolen from this deck. It's just unlucky on my part that I come in the middle of the week. But that was mine, so I'm not copying. Somebody else did, but he is the CTO, so that's okay, I suppose. All right, so research and prep. We have no idea how long this takes. We can't possibly know how long they're researching because the attack hasn't been enacted yet. We do know, though, from the first host compromised, that it is up to 48 hours before the domain admin is subsequently compromised. The common path from that entry point to the domain admin uses an attack referred to as pass the hash or pass the ticket. I'm sure most of you have heard of that. Give me a quick show of hands who's heard of the pass the... Yes, okay, that's what I thought. And how many of you have already heard that Windows Server 2016 effectively renders that attack moot? So for those of you that raised your hand before and not now, it has. We have a feature called Credential Guard. It encrypts those credential artifacts in memory, and Jane's going to give you a demonstration of that in a second, by showing you how the attack works with and without Credential Guard. The attack basically fails as soon as Credential Guard is switched on. The attacker can go undetected for 150 plus days. We have varied numbers here, so we're sort of getting a bit sketchy around there, but that's almost half a year. This is a long, long time that they're in there for. And obviously during that time, they've managed to exfiltrate all kinds of data. Now, the anatomy of the attack gets quite interesting. So if you take a look here, this is how they get in the front door. It's a browser or a doc exploit, the ones that we're all very, very aware of. Secondly, they take control of that device. And then they start trying to grovel for additional credentials on that device. If that device happened to be just a regular machine by a regular employee who had no privileges throughout the organization, but that employee had local admin privileges, then they have everything they need. I'll tell you how the attack goes from there. They've detected a user with local admin privileges once they attack the machine through, say, the browser exploit. They then start installing a piece of software that will draw the computer's performance, something that's got a very heavy compute burden. And it will be named, and it will look just like a Windows process. Oftentimes, you see SCV host instead of SVC host. They do stuff like that to make it difficult to spot. What then happens, because the CPU is being dragged to a halt, what does the person who owns that PC do? They call the support desk. What does the support desk guy do? They log on remotely over RDP. And it's fairly certain that the guy on the support desk, that help desk individual, is going to have more privilege than the user who only has privilege on this machine. They steal those credential artifacts, and then the attack continues. So it's 1 to 5, 5 to 100, 100 to 10,000, and you can see how it pans out, 24, 48 hours later, domain admin is gone. That's precisely what is happening there in the expand piece, and obviously they then get hold of the asset, whatever it was that they were after. However, what do the vast majority of the attacks that we've seen, the malware attacks, the encryption attacks, what do they all have in common? They are all typically seeking one thing, with the exception of ransomware. The one thing that they are seeking, which is not obvious until you look at it, is admin privileges. Pass the hash is no fun if you've got the hash of a guest account. Pass the hash is no fun if you've got the hash of a service account that only has permission to one machine. Pass the hash is only useful right alongside pass the ticket if you've got the cred artifacts of something with significant privilege. So if you take a look, we've got a bit of a problem here. We gave out the keys to this kingdom years and years and years ago. I went through a list of operating systems to see how many people in the audience had been around the industry as long as I have. So I'll start that again real quickly. How many of you used Windows NT 4? A lot of you. How many of you were around for Windows NT Advanced Server 3.1? Question mark on the advanced. How many of you were around for OS 2? You are as old as I am. So you know LAN Server, 3 plus Open, 3 plus Share, Novell Netware. Think back. Every single one had a notion of an administrative role. Netware, supervisor. Unix, Linux, Xenix, every derivative, root user. Windows, OS 2, LAN Manager, LAN Server, 3 plus Open, 3 plus Share, Administrator. Time and time again, we've used this same operating principle. So the first thing that we thought of to address this problem was rip the covers out from underneath you. Just remove the entire concept of an admin role. We gave that thought about 4 to 5 minutes of credence and then dismissed it as stupid. There's no way that we can take away the entire operational model on which IT infrastructure is run these days, the notion of an admin role. So we had to do something a little bit more. We can't just pull it away. We have to find a way of controlling it. So if we break these attack vectors down and you look on the left side of this chart shows you the things that we're used to. We're used to dealing with these with Defender and various forms of anti-malware or antivirus software. We've got network firewalls and all these policies that can be pushed down. Software-defined networking can help with this by using micro-segmentation to push down synthetic network devices, appliances that serve the purpose of a firewall, protecting a role from attack in some cases. But what about the one on the right? How many of you have considered this an attack vector? Attacking the virtualization fabric. Not too many companies run incredibly sensitive workloads as VMs. Domain controllers, for example. That is still one of the sticklers. It's not there in virtualized workloads in anywhere near the volume of file servers and SharePoint servers and web servers. They keep domain controllers on bare metal because it eliminates the segregation of duty between a fabric admin and a domain admin when you virtualize a domain controller. I owned Active Directory for a number of years in Microsoft, and I tried a number of features to try and increase the penetration of AD being virtualized. We designed something called VM Generation ID to allow Active Directory to understand when it had been rolled back in time using a snapshot, and it would make the directory database safe. We then invented a technology called domain controller cloning to see if we could make people deploy domain controllers really fast, but only if it was a virtual machine. And even that made a little bit of a dent, but not much. People are hesitant to do this because a fabric admin or an attack on the fabric can simply steal the artifacts that comprise a virtual machine and a domain controller. That's just a VHDX file. Copy it off, take it home, and then hammer on the directory database. So we've seen that for a long, long time now. So this is another attack vector that we needed to look at in Windows Server 2016 and address. So here's what we would consider to be our overall security posture, our engineering tenets, if you like. The first one has never changed, and we're not wavering now. We still do everything we can to protect these workloads and systems from being attacked, from being poisoned in the first place. But unfortunately, attacks will happen. Human beings are not perfect. We make mistakes. We can also be fooled. It's very, very easy to be fooled and to type your credentials into a website when you're getting used to typing your credentials into websites. Unfortunately, that's becoming more and more prolific as we sort of stray away from that utopia where we had single sign-on for all the on-prem resources. There's not quite as much single sign-on these days. So unfortunately, that trains us to enter our credentials. So now you've got to be ever more diligent about where you enter those credentials. You may well enter them into a website that looks like what you thought it was, but in actual fact, it's been stood up to look like what you thought it was, and they're stealing your creds. They may even redirect you to the right site. Then we've got detect. We have to put detection mechanisms in place. I'll give you an example. One of the best candidates for, say, Active Directory, since that was the one I was picking on a second ago, we have a product called Advanced Threat Analytics. It's behavioral analysis. It monitors the behavior of users and resources and servers such that when anomalous behavior occurs, it can red flag it. It monitors where tickets are issued, and if the ticket is then used at another location to which it was not issued, it raises another red flag. That's a feature from the Azure AD team called Advanced Threat Analytics, or ATA. That's a bolt-on to your existing Active Directory. You don't have to upgrade it. You don't have to change it to Server 2016. Then there's obviously response. We have a variety of technologies around response, which is where we're pushing out anti-malware software. We're providing updates to Defender to make sure that we've got the latest signatures for all of this malware software that's out there. Last but not least, and I think it's one of the more important ones, it's also somewhat of a revolution in Server 2016, that is isolate. We now use, in both Windows 10 and in Windows Server 2016, virtualization technologies for the purpose of security. Now, I've often asked, it's somewhat of a rhetorical question, but most of us are comfortable now with the notion that if I run Virtual Machine 1 on a hypervisor, I don't care whether it's Hyper-V or VMware or Citrix, it doesn't matter. If I run Virtual Machine 1 on that hypervisor and Virtual Machine 2 on the same hypervisor, I think we all have some peace of mind now that there are protections in place that prevent Virtual Machine 1 from attacking VM2 and VM2 from doing the opposite. They are only allowed to talk to each other by virtue of the workload they're running. The rest of the fabric that happens to be shared doesn't matter. The isolation technologies are in place. We're using the same isolation technologies that virtualization in the platform is used to provide Hyper-V and Citrix and VMware. We're using those same technologies now in Windows 10 for security purposes. We refer to it internally as virtual secure mode, and it's an implementation of an industry principle called virtualization-based security. You may well see it listed on our marketing magic as virtualization-based security, VSM, or VBS. That's all the same thing. Shielded virtual machines, credential guard, remote credential guard, device guard, they are all built on top of this ability to rely on platform technologies such as second-level address translation, IOMMUs that provide DMA defenses for DMA attacks. All of these things are there. They've been ever present in hypervisors for quite some years. They're now present in Windows 10 as a client. All of those capabilities live there, credential guard, device guard, etc. And they also exist in Windows Server 2016. So the underlying message there is security isn't something you bolt onto the edge. It's an architectural principle. We fully embraced that with this release to the extent where we've even changed the boot path of the operating system. Windows 10, one of the first things it loads is the hypervisor. Not because it's going to run virtual machines, but because it leverages the hypervisor's control over the platform technologies to implement those security capabilities that we refer to, as I said, as virtual secure mode. So first things first then, let's take a look at how we would protect credentials and privileged access. Here's one of the biggest problems. Somebody manages to attack Ben. Ben gets Mary. Mary gets Jake. Jake gets admin. Admin gets domain admin. 48 hours later, your domain is owned by some rogue attacker that now possesses credentials of a domain admin user. The typical administrators in today's networks, if you take a look at this, they have unbounded time. They log on as a domain admin, and they can log on for as long as they like. And they have unbounded privilege. They may not even need the privilege. They may need only a server admin privilege, and yet they frequently log on as a domain admin. Far more than was necessary. And they also log on and use that account for functionality that they should not run under that particular security context. For example, should you run a web browser and browse the web when you're logged on with domain admin privilege? The answer is no. It's a rhetorical question. I'm hoping most of you know that too. Not a good idea, because that's going to be the end of your network if some malware manages to infect you while you've got that particular security context in play. What we want it to look like is more like this. By using just enough admin and just in time admin, we can narrow it down so that you only have the permissions that you need, and you only have them for the period of time that you need them. JIA, or just enough admin, is a PowerShell delegated admin or role-based technology that allows you to define precisely the level of access that somebody needs. It allows you to say, you can run this commandlet, but not that one. You can use this argument, but not that one. You can provide this value to this argument of this commandlet, but not that one. So we can constrain, say, DNS admins down to a very, very small subset that represents only the administrative functions that they need to perform. Used in conjunction with the Microsoft Identity Manager, privileged access management functionality, MIMPAM, if you like, but that's not a very cool name, so let's just go with the longer one. You can use JIA in conjunction with MIMPAM so that you can JIT, or just in time, increase your privilege, thereby giving you more functionality, but it was audited. And there may have been a workflow required before you were allowed to take on this stronger set of privileges. The workflow could be Azure AD submits a multi-factor authentication request to your phone and you need to do a biometric scan. That's one possibility. It could just be that your manager is sent an email and they have to click an acknowledge button, that you are requesting some additional privilege that you do not have for every single day duties. And then we constrain it in time. There's a new feature in Windows Server 2016 Active Directory called time-bound groups. This allows you to specify how long a user is in a group for at the point that you add them to the group. So I could add you to a group and say you are allowed in this group for 30 minutes. As soon as you re-authenticate, you will get that group membership SID in your tickets and in your tokens, and you will be whatever that group is. But 30 minutes later, it will expire, because Kerberos has been enlightened to time-bound groups. So when you authenticate as that user whose membership in a group was time-constrained, the ticket will be the lowest common denominator of any time-constrained group. So in the example I just gave you, your tickets would last precisely 30 minutes, at which point they will expire. You will need to re-authenticate, at which point you're no longer a member of the group. Removal from the group happens in real time. I cannot stress that enough. It is real time, no replication latency. This is a Windows Server 2016 capability that is used. It's exploited fully by the Identity Manager Privileged Access Management solution. So there's a lot of stuff going on under the covers that you don't necessarily see. So let's go ahead and give you a demonstration then of JIT and JIA working in unison. So I'll hand it over to Jane.
Thank you, Dean. So I'm going to use the scenario. I'm going to be a DNS server operator. Dean has mentioned DNS server and domain administrator are typically sitting on the same machine. So if I want to go into the DNS server trying to investigation of issues, what permission do I need? I need the administrator right on that domain controller. And therefore, I need a domain admin. As Jin just mentioned, that's really not a good idea. The higher the number of domain or the administrators you have, the bigger the attack surface. And that's where I'm going to demo with Jia to see how I can limit the commandlets or to give the DNS operators, I can do my work. So here, I'm coming to my workstation. Connect to my DNS server. Just to show you, I'm just a domain user, doesn't have the domain admin privilege. So I'm going to just connect it through the remote connection. Expected, I shouldn't have access because I don't have the domain admin privilege. My admin has created this Jia endpoint. Allow me to get all the information that I need. Take a look on the right-hand side here. Now, the number of commandlets I can access, most are the get. Allow me to do all the investigation, gather all the information that I need to take a look and why investigating the DNS issues. After some troubleshooting, I decide, looks like the DNS cache has been poisoned, so I need to clear the DNS cache. I don't have that commandlet. Now I come to the PAM portal page. This is what Dean has mentioned, that to temporarily activate myself as the DNS admin. Provide the justification. As default here, you can see I only have 30 minutes. Now I can come back to my domain commandlet window. Also, on this portal page, you can also audit to see who has been requesting permissions. It's a very good way to audit who has done what on the servers. I just need to open a new PowerShell session. This time, I elevated myself as the DNS administrator. So in addition to the operator commandlet I was able to get access to, I have a lot of other commandlets. Now I can actually go in and fix the issues. So let's try to clear the DNS cache. It's available to me now. All right, let's just run it. You know, while I'm at it, I might as well just restart the service just to make sure. Okay, the commandlets is available to me. Oops, I didn't mean to restart the domain service. I really want to only restart the DNS service. I'm showing this mistake intentionally to show you how Jia not only allow you to define the commandlets that you are wanted to give the role to access, but also the value to the parameters. And that's how Jia and JIT can provide you the way to restrict the administrators in your environment.
Great, thank you, Jane. So just to be clear there, yeah, that it does. I'm not sure if they're giving you a round of applause or the technology, but we'll take it for either way. So I want to be clear here. When Jane tried to restart NTDS, that's the Active Directory service itself, it was not some ACL on the service config manager. It wasn't the registry doing anything here. It wasn't the service config manager in any way, shape, or form. That was Jia saying, you are not allowed to submit that value. The only value I permit you to submit is DNS cache. That's one value because that's the client-side DNS cache, and DNS server because that's the DNS server-side cache. Jia was the fundamental control that was in place there, not Windows itself. Okay, so now we'll take a look at Credential Guard then. Credential Guard effectively does the following. It allows you, on a modern Windows 10 or Server 2016 computer to leverage virtualization technologies for security purposes. What we do is we encrypt the artifacts in memory so that anybody that tries to steal them would need the encryption key. The encryption key lives within that secure bubble that I mentioned earlier is referred to as virtual secure mode. So you have to go and ask virtual secure mode. So malware out there that steals these credential artifacts out of LSA memory is now only stealing encrypted copies of those artifacts. And it would need to ask VSM and the relevant trustlets that run inside there to decrypt that for it. So Jane, why don't you go ahead and give him a demonstration of credential guard. Jane is now going to turn into a malicious individual. I realize looking at her, that's quite hard to believe, but she is going to attack an Active Directory system, steal a hash, and then try and impersonate somebody by doing so.
Thank you, Dean. So imagine I'm wearing my hacker hat. Remember at the beginning when Dean showed that Attack Academy, where most attack actually start with phishing email, and no different this time, I send Dean phishing email. I know he likes cars, so I sent him some really nice car deals. And he logged on, I got hold of his credentials. And now I log on to the server with his credential. So my end goal here is to get the domain admin privilege. Once I get that, I can do anything I want in that domain. So let's just, I'm just log on to machine, so I'm gonna see if he has the domain admin privilege or not. What's the easiest way to do it? I'm just going to add Dean to the domain admin group. Well, okay, not that lucky this time, so.
Damn it.
You probably seen this also in the keynote already. This is a very common tool to take a dump of the memory to see what the credentials has been left footprint on this server. So it just goes on and on and on. And this is where I think server is typically a bigger target because a lot of people connect to it. And likely you're going to have a domain administrator somewhere. But if not, just like Dean mentioned previously, I can just take another account information here and then try it on another machine. But hey, I'm lucky this time, I found the domain admin. I don't have the credentials, but that's the NTLM hash in clear text right there. That's enough for me to try to do something with it. So I'm going to take a copy of this and try to launch another command here. At the bottom, I specify the user, and I don't specify the credential. I just need to say NTLM hash and open a commandlet with that NTLM hash. Okay? Guess what I'm going to do again? I'm going to try to add Dean into the domain admin group.
Because that's a good idea.
If I can type it.
Yes.
Hey, what do I have? I have upgraded him from a domain user to a domain admin, and I have his credentials. I can do anything I want at this point. And now let's come to another machine that has credential guard enabled. Okay, not this window. First, I want to show, just to confirm, this machine does have credential guard enabled. Just open system information, and at the bottom here, you can very easily deploy this through group policy.
The key piece of information there was hypervisor enforced, and then it said, I think, device code integrity as well as credential guard. Those are the pieces of information you want to be looking for to make sure it's on sensitive systems.
So here I have same loads of information, but and also notice I have same the domain administrator here. But notice instead of the NTLM hash in clear text, I have this encrypted blob. And this is where Dean was saying earlier, the information now is all encrypted in the memory, and the encryption key is stored in that very secure, isolated VSM or VBS environment. Not even the administrator will be able to get hold of that key. And that key stays on the device. That's how credential guard is going to stop the path of hash attack.
Great. Thank you very much, Jane. So that is now a default. As long as you have the hardware and the hardware's firmware, has the virtualization capabilities, typically second-level address translation, often called SLAT, or IOMMU, which is for DMA protection. You typically need both of those. If they are both switched on, then you can simply configure a group policy to enable credential guard, and that is the end of that pass the hash attack. That particular approach can no longer be used. It's also the same for pass the ticket. All right. That still leaves one other kind of logon, though, and it's a kind of logon that happens frequently against servers. When you log on over RDP, have any of you ever considered why you always have to enter credentials? When you connect to a file server in your organization, it doesn't ask you to log on. It uses Kerberos single sign-on. Yet when you log on to an RDP server, you may well be logging on as the very same user that you're logged on at where the workstation is. So why doesn't it use Kerberos single sign-on? Good question. We don't know now. We've kind of forgotten. We decided to fix that. By fixing it and then by adding some additional pieces on the end, we've effectively provided the same level of technology in terms of the protection that Credential Guard gives us locally over an RDP connection. And we cleverly called that Remote Credential Guard. So Jane's going to give you a demonstration of Remote Credential Guard. You'll see a single sign-on attempt, and the end result is there will be no credentials left in the clear on the RDP host. The credentials were never even there, not in their raw form, because you, again, logged on using Kerberos single sign-on.
Right. So first, I'm going to just remind you of that RDP experience going to be without Remote Credential Guard. So here, it prompts you to enter your credentials. Just going to cancel that out and do it again. Now you can specify remote guard. And that tells the RDP client to use remote credential guard for this connection. You can also deploy group policy to make the default or preferred way of RDP connection using remote guard here, so that people, even they don't specify the parameter with the remote guard, they will still use the remote credential guard in the RDP connection. Once these get connected, what I want to show you also on the server side, in this case, I'm making that vulnerable server that where I showed you the clear text of NTLM hash as my RDP server. Why do I want to do that? So I can show you with RDP, with remote guard, what kind of footprint stored in the memory cache for the credentials. Now I connected without entering my credential. That's the single sign-on experience that Dean has mentioned. And now I want to come to the RDP server and do the same thing about dumping all the credentials. Remember, when I didn't enter my credentials, so whoever I logged on as would be, that credential will be used to do the RDP connection. So again, if you see all the other accounts, that you can just see the NTLM hash in clear text. Now, when I did my connection with my account under the remote credential guard, although this machine doesn't have credential guard, remote guard protects my credentials on the RDP server. So you may wonder now, if the RDP server doesn't have my credentials, can I still connect to network shares, other servers in the network? Let me coming back to this RDP server connection. I'm just going to open Explorer and connect to a file share that I created for myself.
Now you've got a square bracket in there.
Oh, sorry.
I know you spelled your name funny, but I didn't think it was a square bracket.
So as you can see, same experience. I don't need to enter my credential. When the RDP server needs to get access to the file server, it routes the request back to the RDP client, and the client will prepare the right token and service tickets and connect to the network.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Now, the key piece in there that I wanted to make sure I point out was, one, Remote Credential Guard is only supported by Server 2016. We've pushed back many of these security technologies to earlier versions of the OS. Gia, for example, works fine down to Win7 and Server 2008 R2. The MIM-PAM appliance can work with any version of Active Directory. It's a bolt-on to the side. But technologies like this, where we're fundamentally re-architecting the way we persist secrets in memory, we can't push that sort of stuff as a backwards compatible update. So these features only exist in Windows Server, Remote Credential Guard at least. And you do have to ensure that you use it. If the group policy is not switched on, you have to remember to type /remoteguard to ensure that you're using the more secure manner of projecting your credentials into the remote server. So just keep that part in mind. All right, now here's a tool that we've got. We call this ADAP, or Active Directory Access Path. The reason we wrote this was we had a feeling, a sense, that customers had perhaps a larger number of domain admins than they actually intended to. In one company, I'm not going to mention who it was, only to say that it was not Microsoft. I do want to be clear there. This was not MS Corp. Take a look at this. In a real-world use case, the scan revealed that they had just slightly over 2,000 domain admins. The actual intention was 20, which is a factor of a lot. That's incredible. It wasn't direct membership in the group. It was through layer upon layer upon layer of group nesting. We ran Active Directory Access Path, and it made that very, very clear to the owners of the IT services in that organization, and they remediated it very, very quickly indeed. But this is a fantastic tool. We are working on releasing this, but at this point in time, this is not a tool that is released. It's only available through consulting services engagements. But we are looking at releasing the tool. We're just having some licensing issues. Hopefully, we'll manage to get past those logistical issues. But you can see here, this is a very, very real problem. People need to be using privileged access management solutions to ensure that this sort of stuff doesn't happen. In addition, we've been working for about 2 years now on this particular website, aka.ms/privsec. It is a wealth, in terms of the information there, of security-related data. One of the things it offers is this guidance across three time periods, 2 to 4 weeks, 1 to 3 months, and then 6+ months. And then it gives you a prescribed list of things that you can do. In the 2 to 4 week time span, this costs no money. It's just operational. We're recommending here that you use LAPS, the local admin password service. This allows you to automatically control and randomize the administrator passwords on domain joined machines. There are two flavors of that. We recommend that you separate users from admins. So you have, if you like, if it was me, it's Dean WE, that would be my regular alias, and then perhaps Dean WE-admin, and I have to log on to that to be an admin of anything. This is simple operational guidance that's very, very actionable. At the 1 to 3 months, we're asking you to install a few additional pieces here that provide much stronger security. Get ATA in there. Start monitoring the behavior of the assets on your network, users, services, the file servers, the computers, the web servers, all those different things. ATA can spot attacks that you would have no other means of detecting. In addition, we would recommend that you start using multi-factor for elevation purposes, smart cards, virtual smart cards, or you can use Azure AD's MFA so that it can buzz your phone and make you do a biometric swipe. At the 6 months point, we're saying, okay, now it's time to get really serious. This one requires a lot of additional effort. Put your domain controllers inside shielded virtual machines. Shielded virtual machines are arguably stronger than putting a physical domain controller on bare metal in a cage, because the shielded virtual machine can be controlled in terms of where it runs. I cannot control a bare metal device. It can be plugged in at your house or plugged in a cage in a data center. It'll power up in either location. A shielded virtual machine can prevent itself from being powered up or live migrated unless it is on a fabric that it trusts. It can literally exert its own trust onto the fabric. That's part of the overall shielded virtual machine value proposition. Take a look at this website. There is a huge amount of actionable guidance there. The end result, your network goes from something that's a bit susceptible to attacks to something that is not entirely bulletproof. Nobody makes immutable security claims in the industry. It's not a wise thing to do. It's more of a game of leapfrog, a game that I would argue at this point we're winning by quite some margin. But this is an improved position, no doubt. So, next then, what about protecting applications and data in any cloud, whether it be private or public? So we'll take a look at some things here. I'm not going to give you a demo of each of them, but we are going to give you a demo of at least two. Control Flow Guard has been in Windows since 8.1, I think it is. It is a piece of technology that prevents attacks against the stack, where we manipulate code pages and we make them run in an unnatural sequence for the purposes of allowing them to reveal secrets that they would otherwise not. I will grant you, this is an incredibly sophisticated attack. It takes developers with some severe skills here, but it's nonetheless an attack vector. Control Flow Guard attempts to preclude those attacks by understanding how the binary is supposed to run and not permitting it to run in any other unnatural manner. Then there's Windows Defender. So Windows Defender is effectively the malware. Windows Defender is anti-malware. It's the same piece of software that's been doing extremely well on the Windows client for some time. We've now included it in box within server. Why is this good? Because we've optimized it for server workloads. It actually understands that it's on a server. How many of you in here ever had issues with antivirus or anti-malware software running on a domain controller when replicating Sysvol? Anyone? Yeah, look at all the hands. That was a monumental nightmare. Well, we've managed to solve that now. Defender does nothing. It understands what normal looks like on these roles. In addition, it has registry hardening. It understands which keys, which values, which data types should not be tampered with. And it prevents tampering against those. And obviously, it understands the signatures of known malware and tries to use learning heuristics to understand when things are also going awry. That's now part and parcel, again, of Windows Server, and Jane's going to give you a quick demo. This is a pretty easy one to see, but it's also very, very brief, so watch carefully.
It's going to be really fast. If you blink, it's going to be gone. So the malware that I run actually was the one that I did for dumping the credentials in memory. I have a zip file. I have to disable Defender, actually, before I was able to do the other demo. So now I'm just going to, if I was the attacker again, I'm going to try to copy it and then extract and try to use it. So I'm just going to, so just watch. Just like that. The moment it rises to the file, it's get deleted. So, because this is a 64-bit machine, so I have no executable on my machine.
Now, I have to say that personally, I think that demo's a bit crap. The reason it's crap is because it doesn't give you any wow moment. But that's the whole idea of anti-malware software. You don't want it being in your face every time it finds something. You want it to just get on with its job and remove it. That's why the demo is a bit underwhelming, but nonetheless, it conveys the message very, very well. The moment that was extracted from the zip file, Windows Defender saw it, removed it from the disk. If she'd managed to run that binary by, I don't know, executing some script and had managed to get it in there a couple of nanoseconds later, even if it had been loaded, Defender will kill the process, and it will then kill the process from which the process was spawned, say a command prompt, and then remove the binary from the disk as well. So it handles all aspects of the anti-malware defense patterns that we're looking for. Last but not least, Device Guard. Device Guard is a clever rebranding of Code Integrity, but it was necessary to rebrand it, because this is hypervisor-enforced Code Integrity. I'll give you a brief description of what it's capable of, and then I'll ask Jane to go ahead and show you a demonstration of this. The reason this is so much better than what we had before is the hypervisor itself is the one that is enforcing the policy. The hypervisor will not permit kernel memory pages to be marked as executable, i.e. a code page, and writable. That's no longer possible. The hypervisor enforces that. There are two ways of deploying this. You can deploy it either locked to the firmware of the machine or just not locked. I'll tell you the difference between the two. If you deployed this as an unlocked device guard policy, an admin could mess with the policy. They could reboot the machine to make whatever they did to the policy. They might have erased it. They could reboot the machine to make that effective, at which point there would be no code integrity policy running on the system. That's not ideal. If, however, you had configured that as locked, it creates a signature of the code integrity policy, and it writes it to a variable in the UEFI, the UFI firmware. Firmware that can only be cleared with physical access to the hardware itself. If you then had an admin when the firmware had the signature of the device guard policy stored in one of its variables and they rebooted the machine, when the machine comes back up, the device guard code will begin to load shortly after the hypervisor magic's been done, will compare the signature to the one inside the firmware, and if the two do not match, we consider that the machine is being attacked by a malicious admin. What do you think the machine does with a locked device guard policy? It gives you a nice colored screen. What sort of nice colored screen can you imagine? What would the color be? Blue. Very good. Windows consciously and deliberately blue screens itself, because by saying that it was locked, you, as the trusted admin of that policy, dictated to Windows that it is preferable to have this server fail than to have its assets stolen. That's what you said when you said lock it to the UFI firmware. So when I say that we are being very, very strong on our security messaging this time around, I hope you get some of that insight from what I've just told you. We will blue screen a box rather than allow it to reveal assets that it shouldn't otherwise be revealed, even to an admin. But it's still down to you to configure it that way. Jane, why don't you go ahead and give them a quick demonstration of Device Guard doing its magic.
Sure. Actually, before I start, I want to know, How many people think that you know all the software that runs in your environment? By that, I don't mean like the legit or the desired expected workload. I mean apps that people just download from the internet, try to put it on the server and try to run it. Do you have a way to track them? Okay, now I can show you a way to track with Device Guard. I think the way I like to describe Device Guard is give you the way or the control to define what you want to trust on the server. It can be very wide, like you can say I trust software that's signed by Microsoft or by other reputable software company, or you can go down to the very strict, I only wanted to run these lists of files, like on your Hyper-V host. Even those good software, I don't want it to run. There's a risk of putting down those servers, and I don't want those reliability issues. So now I have, and they're also for Device Guard, and you can create these code integrity policies on what you want to trust. At the beginning, when you create the policy, you want to run it in audit mode, just like what I have on this machine. Under audit mode, what it means that even the files that are not covered by the code integrity policy, it will still load, just like how user would expect it. This is a legit software I download from the internet. I'm going to just let it run. There's no interruption. There's no difference in the user experience. However, if you wanted to see what's in the event log, that's where it's going to leave a trace. There's a code integrity channel. I'm going to refresh it. And I hope I, well, for people at the back, probably it's very hard to see. I'm going to try to zoom it in. Now, everything that's not covered by the event, by the code integrity policy, is you can come to the event log and take a look at what are the files that get run on these servers and not covered by my CI policy. And then you can make a choice. Do I want it to run? Then you can add these files into the CI policy, or you say, I don't want it to run. At a later stage, when you change your CI policy from the audit mode to the enforcement mode, all the files that's not covered by the CI policy will be blocked. Let me show you how that looks like. This server is identical, have the same application. The only difference is this one runs under the enforcement policy, and now it's going to get blocked because of the CI policy on this machine.
Great, thanks, Jane. Right. So you saw that there are a number of config permutations for Device Guard. It can do both kernel mode and user mode, or just kernel mode. It can lock the policy to UEFI firmware to prevent administrative attack, or not. In addition, there's the way in which you specify the configuration policy. Do you look at certificates for signer signatures, or do you simply look at file paths or hashes of binaries? There's a lot of flexibility in configuring this thing. It even has the ability to slurp up all of the event logs when running in audit mode and then transfer everything it found over into an enforce mode policy. That's kind of a handy feature. I will tell you that you need to manage this tool very, very carefully, because it can prevent Windows, it's that low down in the stack, it can prevent Windows from loading drivers if you said they're not permissible. So this is way down deep in the heart of Windows. It is not something that's on the top that just affects Command Prompt and Explorer. We can literally stop Windows from booting if you get it wrong, which is why we recommend you deploy audit mode. Now, that may sound like an unsafe idea, but the goal is it has to be strong enough to put blocks in place for rogue device drivers. We have to be able to do that, otherwise that would be the remaining attack vector. Hence, you need to deploy in audit mode first and then figure out when you're good to go to transfer to enforce mode. So what about responding more intelligently then? We've enhanced the logging in Server 2016. In the past, the logs would just give you sort of very kind of vague information in certain areas that you knew that something had gone wrong, but there was nothing action about the event log. It was more about what happened as opposed to an action to fix it. The idea that we've gone through here is we've sort of parsed a good number of the event logs, and we've tried to gain some clarity on what went wrong and then give a direction in terms of how you should begin to remediate this. In addition, if you had the ability to read event logs across thousands of computers, you as a human being may well be able to correlate an attack that's occurring or something untoward because it was happening across 1,000 machines. But unfortunately, as human beings, we simply can't digest that much information. So this is where OMS comes into the picture. OMS has the ability to consume all of these event logs and start using big data processing up in the cloud to figure out if something untoward is indeed going on, and then raise flags for you on a configurable dashboard. There have been a number of OMS sessions in this particular Ignite, and I would encourage you to go see some even in the streaming mode if you haven't done so already. Next, protecting applications with just enough operating system. We all know in the past that we've had hypervisors that could do this sort of kernel level isolation for, hypervisors that can do virtual machine isolation, and then we use the Windows kernel to do process isolation between two applications. Modernizing things a bit, we now have Hyper-V containers, which are a more efficient form, a smaller footprint of a virtual machine that applications can run in the most part, completely unchanged. Far faster boot times than a virtual machine, the application can load and potentially scale. If it's a scale-out scenario, you could make it scale far more quickly. In addition, we now have something called NanoServer. NanoServer is not the same as Server Core. Server Core still exists. If you like to think of it like this, we have Windows Server and we call it Client-y Server. It's the one with the full GUI on it. Server Core was born from that by removing the client-y pieces and leaving just the bare minimum to make it a server. But it's a lot larger than necessary. Nano was built from the ground up, and we continued engineering Nano until we had enough of an operating system there that was both secure and able to run something and do something useful. Nano is very, very small indeed. There have been a number of sessions on Nano as well. It can be deployed in low double-digit seconds, and its footprint on the disk is measured in well under a gigabyte, typically around 500 to 600 meg, depending on what role you're going to install. Nano would be typically used, say, for example, as a Hyper-V instance. It's a very, very useful OS on which to run Hyper-V to have a large-scale fabric. So, next, software-defined networking and micro-segmentation. That's, again, something that's delivered in the Windows Server 2016 wave. Take a look at this particular attack here. I've got some users, and they're happily using the networks via a public VIP, and then there are internal VIPs on the opposite side. We've got a file server and AD that sits behind it. Suddenly, one of those users is bribed. Let's assume that they're bribed, and that's they've got the evil hat on that Jane mentioned earlier. And they begin to initiate an attack against the network. Initially, the attack starts off slowly. They manage to get one of the web servers. From there, they move to the second web server, jump across the private VIP onto the two file servers, ultimately landing on Active Directory, at which point they begin to exfiltrate secret after secret after secret. We may not even be able to see this happening. Hopefully, there would be technology monitoring services in your network that would prevent this. SDN allows me, using micro-segmentation principles, to put the necessary components into place by applying policies to individual subnets and by installing synthetic or, if you like, appliance-like software-defined firewalls in between the prominent portion of the network and the sensitive components. So in this case, I've layered a subnet policy on top of the two web servers. I'll also go and add a virtual appliance, a firewall appliance, in front of Active Directory to ensure that it only talks to blessed nodes. If you were to go ahead and add a new virtual machine to the subnet on which the two web servers reside, the policy would be automatically added to that node as well. That's all handled by software-defined networking, and we refer to that as micro-segmentation. You can refer to it as firewalling and various other policy-driven networks. What about protecting the virtualization fabric? This is the one that I've mentioned a number of times. An attack vector here is so scary. If the Hyper-V admin, or the VMware admin, or the Citrix Xen admin, or the VirtualBox admin, it doesn't matter. This is a susceptibility that is true of all hypervisor implementations, not just Hyper-V. What happens is the admin will leverage their admin ability on a box, and they will steal the VHDX of a virtual machine. They take it home with them on a USB stick and steal its secrets. You don't even know that it happened because there was no auditing. It was outside the purview of the operating system itself. The VM didn't see it happening. With shielded virtual machines, we have the ability to leverage the same hardware-like security capabilities. So what do I mean by that? I mean, in hardware, we use TPMs. We use UFI, secure measured boot. We seal keys to boot measurements so that BitLocker will only allow the disk to be decrypted if the boot measurements line up with a known healthy state. We could never do any of that with virtual machinery simply because we didn't have UFI firmware. We didn't have a TPM. Now we do. With shielded virtual machines, we inject a synthetic TPM into the virtual machine. The virtual machine must be generation 2. It has UEFI secure measured boot capabilities. It doesn't even know that it's using a synthetic TPM. On the Hyper-V host running the shielded VM, the TPM runs inside virtual secure mode using the same virtualization-based security technology as Hyper-V itself is using to protect virtual machines from one another. In addition, the Hyper-V host has to pass rigorous measurements. And when I say rigorous, I mean seriously rigorous. We will measure the boot path of a Hyper-V host all the way up to the point where it's now completely booted and ready for you to log on. We will measure its hypervisor-enforced code integrity policy, and we will look at the endorsement key inside its trusted platform module. If we recognize the TPM, which is a very, very difficult thing to attack, if we recognize the hypervisor-enforced code integrity, and if we recognize the boot path, every single driver that constitutes boot, if we recognize all of those as the same as a known whitelist in a service called the Host Guardian Services database, then we give the machine a health certificate. Only after all that happens is it allowed to either power on a shielded VM or receive one through live migration. The TPM inside the virtual machine, the shielded virtual machine, is not bound to a physical TPM. It is encrypted using keying material that is not local, at least in the clear, to the Hyper-V host. If you were to copy off the VHDX of a shielded virtual machine and try and run it on another Hyper-V instance, it will simply fail because without the VTPM, you can't run through the secure boot measurements to unseal or release the key to decrypt the BitLocker key that is needed to decrypt the disk. In addition, shielded VMs can bless fabrics that they are permitted to run on. You could say, I allow it to run on main data center and DR sites 1 and 2. That would give that shielded VM 3 entirely separate fabrics that it could run on, but if it was stolen and taken to any other fabric, it will not execute. It simply will not power on because it cannot have its VTPM decrypted. So if you make that comparison that you were just seeing on screen there, this is what the interaction looks like. I've got a guarded host on the left side, and it's got a shielded VM, the one that's blinking at you, and it's got a shield icon on it. You'll notice that there's a corresponding key in the host guardian service. So the Hyper-V host needs to go and ask, can I have some more keys? And I've obviously given you a bit of an Oliver Twist reference there, so I may as well do the meaningless accent. Please, Governor, can I have some more keys? That'll go flying on over to the host guardian service, and the host guardian service will then say, okay, yes, I recognize you, and I must say you're looking terribly healthy today, at which point it sends back a certificate of health, along with the key which gets ingested by virtual secure mode. It's still encrypted on the wire. It's still encrypted when it lands on the Hyper-V host, and then it gets plugged into virtual secure mode. Now the same defenses are up again. Only virtual secure mode has the ability to decrypt that. We now stand up a VTPM, a runtime binary called a trustlet, that runs inside virtual secure mode, and it then projects the TPM device out into the virtual machine. The virtual machine powers on. It doesn't even know it's a VM. It sees a TPM V2. It sees UEFI secure measured boot, and it uses UEFI secure measured boot to seal, or to rather release or unseal the key from its synthetic TPM, which allows it to decrypt the BitLocker key, and therefore the machine boots and it's available. The fabric admin cannot steal its disk. The fabric admin cannot attach debuggers to the host because we measure that. The fabric admin cannot attach a debugger to the virtual machine worker process, VMWP, if you know what I'm talking about, because it runs as a protected process. Protected processes do not permit other processes to be attached to them. PowerShell Direct is disabled for shielded VMs. File integration copy components, KVP exchange, all of these things are turned off. It is effectively a black box to the fabric admin. There are two modes of shielding as well. One is designed for absolute security, where to the fabric, it is nothing but a black box running whatever it's running. It has no insight into that. The other is referred to as encryption supported. Encryption supported mode gives you all of those same capabilities with a VTPM and UEFI secure measured boot and BitLocker disks and all that good stuff. However, the fabric admin is trusted. Therefore, console connections work. You still have an encrypted disk, but console connections work. PowerShell Direct works. The file copy integration components work. KVP exchange works. So if you wanted to run a workload that up until today had only been permissible on bare metal because it required, say for example, payment card industry DSS certification 3.2. Today you may only be able to run that on bare metal. Tomorrow when Server 2016 comes out, you can simply move that workload into a shielded VM and it will instantaneously attain PCI DSS 3.2 because it is now providing encryption at rest. In addition, every live migration event is also encrypted using keys derived from the same key that encrypts the VTPM. So it's also encrypted on the wire. Whatever the workload does, though, is down to it. If it's a domain controller, then it speaks LDAP and probably RDP and WinRM and Kerberos. If it's just an RDP server, then it speaks RDP. It does whatever it wants to do. We simply prevent Fabric admins from abusing the privilege that they have, rather like the Matrix over Neo. They can't abuse that stuff anymore. It's that same sort of convention. So let me go ahead and give you a demonstration of this. This is my baby. I own Shielded VMs, so I'm going to do the driving on this one, if I can switch the screens, that is. So let's start by showing you the attack vector. Where did you go? There it is. So here I am, logged on. I'm going to be that malicious Fabric admin. I could be a SAN admin, for that matter. I'm going to double-click on the SAN, and I'm going to go looking for the virtual machine disk of an Active Directory domain controller. You can see I've got a hybrid Fabric running both VMware as well as Hyper-V, because I've got VMDKs on the SAN. I go into VHDs, and there it is, Active Directory Domain Controller 1. Now, I want you to watch carefully, because this is a very complicated attack I'm about to execute. It's called the double-click attack. Okay, done. That's it. I double-clicked on the VHDX of a virtualized domain controller. And for those of you that know AD, does anyone recognize that file system layout? Looks very similar, right? Let's go into the NTDS folder. And there's my database. I right-click, I copy. Go back up to this PC, come in here, and I've now got a copy of the NTDS.dit without Active Directory having any awareness that that occurred. Where was that logged? It sure as hell wasn't logged by the domain controller, because again, the domain controller is Neo. He's in the Matrix. This happened on the outside. They have no purview into this. This would be a SAN admin abusing their privilege, or a Hyper-V admin abusing their privilege, or worse, a SAN admin colluding with a Hyper-V admin. Then it's all bets are off, because they're going to be able to do just about anything. So let me show you how I would go ahead and deploy a shielded virtual machine that would prevent that from occurring. I'll use the Azure Pack interface for this one, but shielded virtual machines are fully supported both in a PowerShell API, so you can use PowerShell to administer it and nothing else. They're also fully supported by System Center Virtual Machine Manager, as well as by Azure Pack itself. So let's go ahead and do a new standalone virtual machine from Gallery, nothing different so far. Here's a regular template. You can see that based upon the cube icon. Regular templates deploy regular virtual machines. Here's the shield icon. Shielded templates deploy shielded virtual machines that are secure from birth. You can see that that's a shielded template by virtue of that shield icon, which our developers spent about 3 minutes working on in Paintbrush using one-bit color and the pencil. Does a good job though, right? I click on next. I'll give it a name, ADDC2. I'll select the shielding data, IT department shielded. Shielding data, obviously this is a question on the top of your mind, I've no doubt now, is the way in which a virtual machine owner securely delivers the secrets to a virtual machine that is being deployed. What secrets do I mean? Let's imagine you're deploying a virtualized domain controller on a fabric in which you've got questionable trust or no trust whatsoever, but it needs to run there. Let's assume that's the nightmare scenario that you've been placed in. You want to deploy that virtualized domain controller as shielded. The last thing you want to do when creating that VM through their web experience is to type in the administrator password to a web form that is owned by the very admin that you are trying to protect the virtual machine from. That would be insane. Shielding data is the way in which we solve that problem. The administrator credentials are stored inside an encrypted lump of secrets that we call shielding data, along with an RDP certificate. Why do we put an RDP certificate in the shielding data? So that you can mutually authenticate the connection when you RDP into the VM once it's finished being provisioned. If you did not have an RDP certificate in there, a malicious admin could stand up a virtual machine that looked exactly like your virtual machine. You RDP to it, and what does it end up doing? Stealing the credentials as you type them into the credential provider. The RDP certificate precludes that possibility. Last but not least, one of the most obvious attack vectors against a shielded VM, if the admin has given up attacking actual shielded VMs, would be to attack the VM before it's born. What the hell does that mean? It means I attack a template disk. Remember, in fabrics like this, all new virtual machines are born from templates. Templates, when running Windows, are typically sys-prepped, put into a generalized state, and then they're specialized by providing an UNA10 file. The same thing is happening here. So if the fabric admin installed malware on the template disk, the shielded VM would indeed be born shielded with malware already inside it. So we had to come up with a method of verifying that a template disk is still integral. The way that we did that is you simply find a trusted admin. It could be you, or it could be somebody on the fabric. Oftentimes, people say, I trust the institution, i.e. you trust Azure. But you don't trust every single employee of Azure. In which case, you may be happy to say, I trust the admins in Azure to create me a template disk and to send me its signature. Or you can create the template disk yourself and upload it to the cloud provider, assuming they support that. We then have a volume signature catalog. You keep that, and it goes inside the shielding data. So I'm now saying, deploy ADDC2 using that shielding data from that template that I showed you earlier on. When provisioning occurs, we go through the whole template disk, and we recompute the signature of that template disk, hash by hash by hash, cluster by cluster. And we then compare it to the signature housed inside the shielding data. If the two are equal, then the disk has not been tampered with since being marked as healthy by the trusted admin. If the two are not equal, then the disk has been tampered with, and we will abort the provisioning of the shielded VM and return an appropriate error. So just about every attack vector that you can conceive of has been shut down. You can't copy the machine off. You can't run it on another Hyper-V host. You can't copy the VTPM. It's encrypted. You can't use console connections. You can't attach debuggers. You can't change the code integrity policy on the Hyper-V host. The disk itself for the VM is encrypted. Its keys are sealed to a VTPM. And even the template disk from which the shielded VM is born is also protected both by being encrypted with something we call a null key, but as well as being signatured. It has a signature of every single cluster, a 2048-bit unique signature representing that disk at a trustworthy point in time. So if I were to go ahead and finish this deployment off, I would simply click on Next, connect it to a network, and then click on the checkmark. Obviously, I've already got one named ADDC2, so I'll bail out there, and I'll show you what the attack vector looks like against a pre-configured one. Firstly, let me show you the VMM interface, and you can see here in the security summary column, ADDC1 is indeed not shielded. It says secure boot enabled. What that effectively means, we could replace that term in the user experience here. We could replace that with a different term. Secure boot enabled and off are roughly the same thing. This machine is not leveraging any of the security capabilities. If you look at ADDC2, it is shielded. Console connections are not permitted. PowerShell Direct, not permitted. Disks are encrypted. Secure boot is enabled. Keys are sealed to a TPM. KVP exchange, not permitted. File integration component, not permitted. Now look at the one beneath it, the encryption supported one. I can console connect to that. Its disks are still encrypted. Its live migration traffic is still encrypted. It still uses a TPM. It still uses secure measured boot. But the fabric admin is trustworthy. Therefore, console connections are permissible. So let me show you that real quick. If I go into the Hyper-V manager, because it's a little faster, and I double click on, say, SQL, you can see here we get a thumbnail. Double click, I get a console connection. Go to ADDC2, which we've just seen is shielded. No thumbnail. Double click on it. You can't connect to it. It's a shielded virtual machine. These are not permissible actions. Now let's go back down and see what happens when I try and mount the disk. Go into there. I'm now going to go and find the shielded virtual machine disk for ADDC2. So it's going to be ADDC2 and then some extension. So we come down into the virtual disks on the SAN. We go into the VMDKs folder. Actually, that's kind of pointless because I know that can't be shielded because they don't support it. Only Hyper-V does. Minor pun there in case you didn't notice it. Double click on Active Directory Domain Controller 2, and I get that the disk isn't initialized. I also say that it's been BitLocker protected. Well, let's see if we go back up to the top. What can I see? I can see it here. It's got a padlock indicating that this disk is encrypted. If I double click on it, I get an error at the top right of the screen saying there are no supported key protectors. For those of you who know how BitLocker works, a key protector is an asymmetric key pair that is used to protect a symmetric key, which is used to encrypt the disk. Windows here is looking for the key protector to decrypt the full volume encryption key of that VHDX, but it doesn't have the ability to do so because it doesn't possess the private keys. So the console connection was not permitted. The disk is encrypted. The VM is mobile within its own fabric. It can be live migrated, but it can't be copied off onto someone else's fabric. You can't attach debuggers to the process or to the host. You can't use console connections unless it's encryption supported. All of these things are native to shielded VMs. So with that said then, let's wrap up with a quick summary and a compliance mapping of what I was talking about earlier on. So here's a quick snapshot, independent data here, not ours. I'm not sure we'd be showing it if it was the opposite way around, but since it's pro for Microsoft, I'll show you it. This data represents us as having the least vulnerable OS 4 years in a row. I find it hard to believe that Server 2016 is going to do anything to jeopardize that. There we go. Taking a different pivot on it, we've focused our attention both on securing the host and on securing the guest. We've got layers of security right the way throughout the OS, ranging from shielded virtual machines through technologies that leverage hypervisor capabilities to secure credentials and secrets inside our guest operating system as well as our server operating system. We've got code integrity policies that are so strong, if someone attacks them, the box will blue screen itself because you told it to, because you locked it to UEFI firmware. The only way out of that is to get physical access to the box to clear the UEFI firmware variable. That's the reason why we consider that such a strong solution. Last but not least, these are five independent compliance mappings that we've used against Server 2016 technologies to make it easy for you guys to solve compliance challenges simply by using one of the Server 2016 technologies. I'll give you an example. Here's the one for shielded virtual machines. You can see that we've managed to nail each of these compliance bars. So if you've got a workload that today runs on bare metal, PCI DSS 3.2 is required, simply run it as a shielded virtual machine, job done. Data is encrypted at rest, and data is encrypted in flight, as long as the workload also encrypts its own traffic. Now, there are four sessions here. The most relevant one to the last topic is number 4 down the bottom there. Oh, no, that's not. I'm sorry. My mistake. It is number 3. Number 4 has already been run. This was a session about the first production deployment of a guarded fabric over in Scotland, and we had one of their directors come over to walk us through the lessons that they have learned while they've been operationalizing a guarded fabric running shielded VMs for the past 9 to 12 months. The data in that slide deck, which is available for you to download, along with a video, is absolute gold. This is also news to us. Imagine what this is like to me. I've got a customer who's already deployed this in a production-ready environment, and now I'm going to use that data to go and produce our own operations guidance. So this is fantastically valuable, not just to you, but also to me. All right. There are some resources. I've already given you some, aka.ms/privsec. There's a whole slew of things up there I would wholeheartedly recommend. Just go and take a look. See if there's anything in there that takes your fancy. I'm sure you'll find something very, very interesting. And there are a slew of demo videos, mostly by me and others around the company that own various technologies that comprise this overall security subset. Don't forget, please do evaluate this session. Let us know if you think either the session itself was fantastic or the products. Both would be obviously optimal. And if you've got questions, please feel free to come up and ask them now. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.